for Leologos Radio, the weekly radio program featuring the best in Greek music and culture, plus interviews with Greek and international newsmakers. Leologos Radio with Michael Nevaralekis begins now. Welcome to another edition of the Leologos Radio, the radio program bridging the worldwide Greek community, airing on 25 radio stations across 5 countries, 4 continents, and online. My name is Michael Nevradakis, and on today's broadcast, the Leologos interview series will be featuring an interview with Greek economist and financial analyst Dimitris Karousos, who will share with us his insights as to the recent deal that was reached between the Greek government and the Troika on the state of the Greek economy and a Greek Greek banking sector today, and on Grexit and the difference between a national domestic currency and a dual or parallel currency. This interview will be followed by the Dialogos Radio commentary of the week, returning to our program after a momentary hiatus. Coming up right now, though, is the Dialogos interview series and our discussion with economist Dimitris Karousos here on Dialogos Radio. The Dialogos interview series, our weekly segment featuring interviews on matters pertaining to Greece and the worldwide Greek community, coming up next here on Dialogos Radio. Joining us today on Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series is economist and financial analyst Dimitris Karousos, who is a member of the political directorate of Greece's United Popular Front and who has enjoyed a long career working for financial institutions within and outside of Greece. Mr. Karousos, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for your kind invitation. I'm very glad to be here with you today.
Let's begin by discussing the recent deal that was reached between the Greek government and its European lenders. The Greek government has engaged in a big PR show portraying this new agreement as one that will not deliver even 1 euro's worth of new austerity measures as a result of the so-called equivalent measures that will be adopted. This begs the question, if the net sum of these new measures is zero, then why enact them? And continuing along this line of thinking, what does the new agreement actually entail and mean for Greece?
As we now find ourselves in Oscar season, it is clear that the Oscar for the best director should go to the communications team of the Greek government, as their new dogma, which claims 1 + 1 = 0, is one of the most absurd things that the Greek people have heard yet. Indeed, Professor Tsipras, by claiming that 1 + 1 = 0, seems to be reinventing the rules of mathematics. In other words, the government is attempting to claim that for every euro of austerity measures and cuts that will be enacted, there will be 1 euro in equivalent measures to offset those cuts. This, of course, is a blatant lie, because if there are indeed will be no impact, these measures will not be needed. The Greek government is lying, and this can be demonstrated in three ways. First, the Troika, meaning the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, is not discussing the possibility of cuts in the special property tax, we call it here in Greece ENFIA, and the value-added tax, and indeed is not even allowing these issues to be brought to the negotiation table. Second, the Troika, instead of tax cuts, is insisting of enacting of the so-called Juncker Growth Package, named after the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. This package is essentially the European Union's Partnership Agreement, known as ESPI or ESPA, as we call it here in Greece. But this is not a true replacement, because Greece already qualifies for the funds from this agreement regardless. Therefore, somebody needs to explain how low-wage earners, who are now faced with a lower tax-free threshold and will be forced to pay taxes, or how pensioners who will face further cuts to their pensions will benefit from the European Union Partnership Agreement, which is in the first place has nothing to do with this group of people, since it's concerned only entrepreneurs, and supposedly offset these cuts. Third, whatever equivalent measures are agreed upon will only begin to be enforced if and only when Greece has fully and successfully enacted new cuts to wages and pensions as foreseen in the new austerity package with 3.6 billion euro worth of cuts.
The deal, which was recently reached, foresees the achievement of a primary budget surplus of at least 3.5% of the Greek GDP in 2019, while we are also hearing that Greece's primary surplus for the month of January surpassed targets. Is this a good thing, however? Are primary surpluses a positive thing for a country like Greece with the economy in a state that it is in?
Here we should first make it clear that no economy which has found itself in a similar condition to that of Greece has been able to recover through the enforcement of strict austerity and the pursuit of surpluses. The economists Barry Eichengreen and Ugo Panizza, in a study of theirs, examined 235 countries and found that were only 36 cases of countries which were able to maintain for a five-year period on average a primary budget surplus of at least 3% of GDP, representing 15% of the total sum. In the same study, they found that were only 17 cases of countries which on over an average of 8 years maintain a primary budget surplus, of at least 3% of GDP, representing just 9% of the total cases. There were only 12 cases of countries which over a 10-year period maintain a primary budget surplus of at least 3% of GDP. It should be noted that Germany, the strongest economy in Europe, was not one of these countries. In other words, they asking Greece to achieve something that not even an economy at the level of Germany's has been able to ever achieve. It should also be added that extraordinarily strict fiscal policies, austerity in other words, with the goal of achieving high primary budget surplus, may in fact achieve the opposite results, leading to recession and to political and social turmoil. These policies, in other words, may lead to the opposite outcome from that which is intended.
We are speaking with economist and financial analyst Dimitris Karousos here on the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series. With this new agreement which has been reached, do you believe that the risk of a so-called Schäuble-style Grexit has been averted, or does it remain a distinct possibility? And continuing on that frame of thought, what would this German proposed Grexit, which would include the imposition of a dual or parallel currency, mean for Greece?
Not only has the threat of Schäuble-style Grexit and the imposition of a dual or a parallel currency not been surpassed, but I believe it remains the plan that will be put into place. I believe the following will happen. Once the Greek government completes the so-called Troika review of its finances with an agreement for a new austerity measures totaling 3.2 to 3.6 billion euros, the Troika will break up the next installment of so-called bailout funds into sub-installments. Once the German election have occurred, then a fake crisis between Greece and its creditor will be orchestrated, and that is when the Schäuble plan, named of course after the German finance minister, will be imposed. This plan will entail Grexit and the imposition of a dual or a parallel currency within Greece. The circulation of a dual or a parallel currency will mean an even more rapid internal devaluation and will signify the immediate impoverishment of the Greek populace. There will be one currency used for internal transactions, such as the payment of salaries and pensions, while whatever euros are still in circulation will be collected and used towards the payment of the national debt, which continue to be denominated in euros. This would be a terrible development for Greece, as this dual or a parallel currency will face constant devaluations versus the euro, as it will not be hard currency, and nobody will want it. If you go to the greengrocer or the baker, for instance, they might accept the dual currency at an exchange rate far lower than the official peg set by the government. The black market for euros will flourish, and the economic catastrophe will be total and complete. The introduction of what will essentially be an IOU or a script will not only completely destroy the Greek economy, but it will also discredit the idea of a national domestic currency in the eyes of the populace.
something which, of course, is not frequently discussed by analysts and journalists and by the mass media in general, is the difference between a dual or parallel currency on the one hand and a national domestic currency on the other hand. What is the distinction and why is one better than the other?
The difference are as follows. By definition, a parallel or dual currency means that there is a different currency in use for domestic transactions from that which is used for external transactions. A national or domestic currency, on the other hand, is a currency that is issued by a nationalized central bank, such as the Bank of Greece, which would be completely state-owned. With a domestic currency, Greece would not be borrowing the currency that it would put into circulation. It will instead mint the currency itself. It is a wealth instrument, not a debt instrument. Furthermore, a national or domestic currency means that the state itself, because it mints its own currency, does not borrow it from any other central bank.
This is the Alagoas Radio. We will return after a short break.
Με μια διαδρομή που κρύβει τόσα μυστικά πανσιόν που μας φιλοξενεί στα βιαστικά με αγχωμένες Κυριακές μέσα σε δίκλινα στενά με χωρισμούς και επιστροφές. Στο πουθενά με χωρισμούς και επιστροφές. Στο πουθενά καρδιά μου πάμε μαζί. Συνήθισε με σαν τη ζωή που σαν ανάσα είναι απλή. Κι αυτό το λίγο πες το πολύ. Μείνω μόνη με δειλή. Συνήθισε με σαν τη ζωή. Γιατί η αγάπη αργεί. Συναντηθήκαν οι ματιές μες στη ζωή μας τη πεζή. Πήγαμε και δυο εκδρομές στην εξοχή. Κι αν παρεμβάλλονται πολλά, τρελή κι αδύναμη καρδιά, στα λόγια σου τα πατηλά. Ζω τη στιγμή, στα λόγια σου τα πατηλά. Ζω τη στιγμή, καρδιά μου πάμε μαζί. Συνήθισε με σαν τη ζωή που σαν ανάσα είναι απλή. Γι' αυτό το λίγο πες το πολύ. Καρδιά μου πάμε μαζί. Να μείνω μόνη με δειλή. Συνήθισε με σαν τη ζωή. Γιατί η αγάπη αργεί. Καρδιά μου πάμε μαζί. Συνήθισε με σαν τη ζωή που σαν ανάσα είναι απλή. Γι' αυτό το λίγο πες το πολύ. Καρδιά μου πάμε μαζί. Να μείνω μόνη με δειλή. Συνήθισε με σαν τη ζωή.
We now return to the Diálogos interview series here on Diálogos Radio. We are on the air with economist and financial analyst Dimitris Karousos here on Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos interview series. Explain for us the steps which Greece could follow in order to undertake an orderly departure from the Eurozone and a return to a true domestic currency. How could the various dangers that we keep hearing about, such as the risk of hyperinflation or a catastrophic devaluation of the new currency, or even the difficulty in importing goods, be averted?
The political party which I'm a part of, the United Popular Front, also known as EPAM, has described in detail 15 necessary steps which are required in order for a smooth transition to take place to a new national domestic currency. Every step in this process is absolutely necessary, and no steps can be skipped, as it will impact the entire transition to a domestic currency. The most important of these steps are as follows. First, disputing the legality of debt and declaring an immediate stoppage of payments. Second, declaring the immediate cancellation of all the memorandums and associated legislation which completely alter the legal and the political status of Greek state and imposed by Troika-led occupation. Third, departure from the European Union and the Eurozone. Fourth, the imposition of a national domestic currency. Fifth, the nationalization of the Bank of Greece, the country's central bank. Sixth, the imposition of capital controls in order to prevent money from leaving the country. Seventh, the liquidation of Greece's four major banks while these banks remain in operation. Eighth, enacting measures to ensure that the transactions are able to take place smoothly during that period of transitions to the new currency. Ninth, ensuring the adequate supply of goods in the marketplace. 10th, protecting consumers and vigorously policing the marketplace and the prices of goods. 11th, immediately restoring wages and pensions to pre-memorandum levels. Finally, implementation of Sisathia, an ancient Greek precedent which refers to the forgiveness of debts of households as well as small and medium-sized business.
Let's take the issues one at a time. How has Greece's membership in the European Union since 1981 and in the Eurozone since 2002 impacted Greece's productive and industrial capacity? And as a second part to this question, is there any possibility of Greece's agricultural or productive or industrial capacity increasing within the European Union and within the Eurozone?
There is absolutely no chance of recovery for the Greek productive sector and Greek industry as long as the country remains within the European Union and the Eurozone, especially when harsh austerity and the memorandums are being imposed. How can industry recover when taxes and pension funds contribution surpass 60% of a corporation's revenue? How can the Greek economy recover when its biggest industry, tourism, is saddled with the highest tax rate in the Mediterranean region? How can the Greek economy recover when there is so much bureaucracy and political uncertainty? The end result of all this is that Greece's competitiveness has dropped to 86th place worldwide, despite all of the austerity measures and the memorandums, the economic growth which repeatedly has promised, and the constant fiscal agreement, adjustment policies and reforms that have been enacted. Despite all of this, Greece now ranks lower in competitiveness than countries such as Namibia, Tajikistan, Albania and Guatemala.
You have spoken about the balance of goods and services in Greece and about Greece's foreign currency reserves. What do these statistics show, and what would they mean for Greece in terms of a potential departure from the Eurozone and the EU and a return to a domestic currency?
There is no possibility that there will be shortages of imported goods, and this is the case because Greece's balance of goods and services, after so many years of economic depression and as a result of internal devaluation that has taken place, is close to being balanced. In very simple terms, this means that Greece, from its exports, tourism and shipping sectors, earns all of the necessary foreign currency, which needs to pay for all of its imports. Therefore, it follows that there will be no shortage of imported goods. In addition, according to the most recent figures available from the Bank of Greece from the third quarter of 2016, the central bank has in its reserves foreign currency totaling approximately 31.5 billion euros. At the same time, Greece's banking system has among its assets a long-term foreign bond portfolio totaling 55.7 billion euros. Together, this total almost 87 billion euros, which could be used as a foreign currency reserves in the immediate aftermath of the departure from the Eurozone. Therefore, it is easy to understand that there is no chance of there being any shortages in the marketplace, and that the Greece needs would be met for several years to come.
There is, of course, also the Greek national debt to contend with. Is this debt sustainable to begin with? And what would you propose regarding dealing with the debt? And what does international law and international legal precedent have to say with regards to actions Greece could implement regarding its debt?
Very much on purpose, the Greek people have been led to believe that an unsustainable debt is one which is very difficult to repay, but which can, at some point and after the enactment of very strict measures, can be repaid. This is absolutely false. We have been led to believe this because, first of all, it has been necessary to maintain the hope that Greece, by enforcing these harsh austerity measures, will be able to repay its debt and will, as a result, accept these difficult measures. In reality, an unsustainable debt is a debt which, no matter a country does, cannot ever be repaid or even reduced, no matter how many measures are enforced. With mathematical certainty, such a debt will be simply increased over time. This is the case in Greece. When Greece received its first so-called bailout, the public debt was 122% GDP. From 122%, it increased to 129%, then again increased to 148%, then to 170%. It has reached 177%, and it's projected to increase to 188%, and later to 200% of GDP if we continue down this path. The first loan agreement, which Greece signed in 2010, and which it should be stressed was not ratified by the Greek Parliament, was a product of fraud and coercion. Articles 48 through 52 of the UN Vienna Conventions of the Law of Treaties allow for the cancellation of a treaty or agreement if it's a product of deceit or threats. This would be permit Greece, with a written statement delivered to the United Nations General Assembly via the United Nations Secretary General, to announce to the international community that it's denouncing its illegal public debt. In addition, the official report of the United Nations Commission on the Human Rights, which was published on its website on the 7th March of 2014, harshly criticized the Greek government for its methodical and repeated violation of human rights, especially the individual, political, economic, social, and cultural rights of Greek people.
We are speaking with economist and financial analyst Dimitris Karousos here on Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series. In our previous interview in January 2016, we spoke about the recapitalization of the Greek banking system, which had just been completed. In what condition does the Greek banking sector find itself in today? Are we headed to yet another recapitalization, and what would such a development mean for Greece?
I would argue that the Greek banking system now finds itself in the worse shape than in the beginning of 2016, if we take into consideration something which the mass media and the most analysts typically neglect to tell us, namely that the deferred tax account for 50% of equity of Alpha Bank, 71% of the equity of the National Bank of Greece, 75%, if I remember correctly, of the equity of the Eurobank, and 58% of the equity of Piraeus Bank. This alone means that the new recapitalization is coming. Moreover, another negative and indeed tragic aspect is that from the beginning of this year, 1.5 to 1.7 billion euros worth of new high-risk loans have been added to the banking system. These loans include mortgages, consumer loans, and business loans, and 90% of these loans had been refinanced. In addition, 2.7 million loans totaling almost 100 billion euros are at the risk of defaults, as payments towards those loans have not been made in over 3 months. This is a ticking time bomb for the financial system. While this is happening, the deposit of households and individual depositors in Greece have been dipped below 100 billion for the first time since 2003. It is therefore clear to me that we will soon see a new recapitalization of the Greek banking system totaling 7 to 10 billion euros.
How has the British economy performed ever since the referendum result in favor of Brexit this past summer? And how do you believe the British economy will perform if and when a process of exiting the European Union is completed? Do you believe the widely held fears of adverse economic impacts will be proven to be correct? Or do you believe the opposite will be true?
Even though it is surely too soon to draw a definite conclusion, what we can say from now is that in contrast with the various Cassandras who foresaw the total collapse of the economy of the Great Britain, what we are seeing is that the British economy grew by 0.6% in the final quarter of 2016, exceeding expectations. In fact, the Bank of England once again revised upward its growth projection for the British economy for 2017, raising its projection from 1.4% of GDP initially, forecast in November 2016, to a growth rate of 2%, of almost 2% of GDP. The higher projection is largely a result of increased consumer spending, which has occurred despite the fear-mongering that the British public faced as a result of the Brexit vote. Two additional aspects that are important and which should also be noted is the reduction of the public deficit by £400 million and the increase in average weekly wages of British workers by 2.8% on a year-to-year basis, of course.
The new president of the United States, Donald Trump, seems to have taken a position in favor of Brexit and against the Eurozone, displaying an evident preference for reaching bilateral trade agreements with individual countries rather than large-scale trade deals with the Eurozone as a whole. On a domestic basis, Trump has promised the return of domestic jobs, of factories and corporations and businesses that have left the country. How do you view the economic policies and promises of the Trump administration, and what would they mean for the European and global economies?
The turn inward being undertaken by the United States will gradually lead to the repatriation of the United States dollars. As a result, it is likely that countries whose national debt is in large part denominated in U.S. dollars, as in the case with Turkey, where 65% of its debt as a percentage of GDP is in dollars, as well as developing countries whose major public and private-owned industries have outstanding loans in U.S. dollar will face increased difficulties from the upward pressures on the dollar in the international financial markets. In addition to all of this, we need to take into consideration the ongoing trade battle between the United States and China and the efforts of the United States to achieve energy autonomy, and in particular the elimination of dependence on the OPEC nations. This means the replacement of approximately 3 million barrels of oil per day, which are currently imported, with domestic energy sources. It is easy to understand that this will hurt countries like Saudi Arabia and Venezuela in particular. As for Trump's domestic economy policies, the jury is still out. We'll just have to wait and see.
Well, Mr. Carousos, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today here on the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series, and for your thoughtful analysis.
Thank you very much for having me.
Attention iTunes users, the Dialogos Radio is now just a click away. You can now download our podcasts and listen to the Dialogos Radio 24/7 anytime, anywhere. Check us out today in the iTunes podcast directory and in iTunes Radio.
Μα όσα κι αν μου πες ψέματα, σ' αγάπησα στα αλήθεια. Μη μ' αποφεύγεις, μάτια μου, μη με κοιτάς αξενή. Ζωή που δεν μοιράζεται, είναι ζωή κλεμμένη. Μη μ' αποφεύγεις, μάτια μου, με κοιτάς αξενή, ζωή που δεν μοιράζεται, είναι ζωή κλεμμένη.
Take the Dialogos Radio on the go with you with the new Dialogos Radio app for Android devices. Now you can listen live to the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos Radio 24/7, download our podcasts, and read our latest articles all in our free Android app, available now in the Google Play Store. The podcast of this interview will soon be available on our website, thealagosmedia.org, where you can also find our articles, commentaries, program archives, and listen to our online radio station, The Alagos Radio 24/7. Our podcasts are also available in the Alagos Radio apps for Android, Kindle, BlackBerry, and Chrome, in iTunes, TuneIn.com in a Windows Store, and in Anobex Radio, WeCast, Player FM, Stitcher, and Podbean apps. Coming up now is the Dialogos Radio's Commentary of the Week. The Dialogos Radio's Commentary of the Week. Each week, Michael Navratakis provides views and opinions on issues pertaining to Greece and to the worldwide Greek community. Coming up next, here on the Dialogos Radio. It's a typical winter's evening in Athens. This has been a cold winter, and the air is brisk. And wherever I go, the sweet smell of success is in the air. And by success, I am referring to none other than the vaunted European dream and the success story of the Greek economy, as described by Greece's former Prime Minister Andonis Samaras in late 2014, and as often repeated, even if not in those exact terms, by Greece's first-time left Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras far more recently. That scent of success comes from the noxious fumes of the fireplaces and makeshift furnaces which newly impoverished Greeks have lit to keep warm, since well over 80% of households are said to be unable to afford absurdly taxed heating oil for their homes. This commentary, though, is not meant to be about Greece, but about the United States, about the anti-Russian hysteria that has taken hold, and the attacks that the newly inaugurated Trump administration is facing from protesters, the media, and the deep state. What does all of this have to do with Greece, though? Everything. Crisis-stricken Greece represents a microcosm of what is transpiring in the United States and much of Europe today, and offers a useful lens through which to analyze current developments. Living in Greece over the past 4-plus years, I've had the opportunity to view politics and economics from a different lens, one far removed from warm and fuzzy claims about the European dream or the utopian vision of open borders and freedom of movement. Greece is a country which has been ravaged by EU and IMF-imposed austerity, its economy and domestic production decimated by EU rules and regulations such as the Common Agricultural Policy, and a country which has been inundated with far more migrants than it could realistically absorb, even during more prosperous economic times. Indeed, the hypocrisy has been astounding. Greece and the Greek people have been blamed for being racist and xenophobic to migrants that have entered the country simply due to its geographical location and as a result of wars and conflicts which other countries have fueled. Greece has been accused of living beyond its means when its welfare state was never as well developed or generous as those of Northern Europe, and where the average incomes have perpetually lagged behind most countries of Northern and Western Europe. The Greek governments of the post-junta period were accused, correctly, of being corrupt, but the EU openly supports these same political parties, such as New Democracy, PASOK, and the current governing coalition of Syriza and the Independent Greeks, which are home to many ex-PASOK and ex-New Democracy members of parliament. This support comes as a result of these parties' unabashed pro-EU, pro-Eurozone stance. Greece is accused of not producing anything when it is during the years of EU and Eurozone membership that Greece's domestic industry and agricultural production were decimated, as Greece's market was flooded with German imports and Brussels bureaucrats told Greek farmers what to grow, what not to grow, and where they could or could not export their produce. On a visit to European Union and NATO headquarters in 2013, as part of an official academic program I was participating in, the contempt with which Brussels technocrats viewed Greece and the other countries of the European South could barely be contained. We were told that Mario Monti, Italy's prime minister at the time, who was not elected but instead appointed at the behest of the EU, was, quote, the best thing that ever happened to Italy. We were told that Mussolini, quote, got the job done. We were told in these exact words that the reasons for the European financial crisis were bad design, bad luck, bad decisions, Greece, period. Or, as EU Trade Commissioner Cecilia Malmström is alleged to have said, she does not receive her mandate from the European people. Or, as Dutch Finance Minister and Eurogroup head Jeroen Dijsselbloem said more recently, the people of Southern Europe blew their cash on women and booze and are therefore not deserving of help. Such is democracy and solidarity in the Nobel Prize-winning European Union. Therefore, when the referendum result in favor of Brexit prevailed in Britain, I was overjoyed. The European Union that I had seen, lived, and experienced was undemocratic, authoritarian, and brutal. In Greece, however, a historical inferiority complex towards the West fostered an attitude of learned helplessness and dependence on the European Union, without which Greece could supposedly not survive. Hence, it was refreshing to see voters in another EU member state standing up to Brussels. This, however, was not the prevalent view in European or North American news media, which reacted in contempt, horror, and disgust at the referendum result. In the United States, snarky late-night television comedians, pandering to the supposedly progressive and hipster crowd, joined the news media's chorus in describing the Brexit referendum result as the product of racism and xenophobia. No mention about austerity, about incomes and pensions that have been slashed in half in Greece, of previously middle-class households unable to heat their homes and burning whatever they could find instead. The EU was, and continues to be, widely described as a force for peace, its open borders touted as a sign of progress. On her recent visit to Washington, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, one of Europe's harshest pro-austerity hardliners, was referred to by the pro-Hillary, pro-globalist Politico as, quote, the leader of the free world. Unabashedly displaying its globalist worldview, the popular feminist website Jezebel previously referred to Merkel as, quote, the last pillar of liberal democracy in Europe. For those of you keeping score, websites like Politico and Jezebel are touting the European Union and the Chancellor of Europe's strongest economy, Germany, as the last bastions of democracy and freedom not just in Europe, but worldwide. The same Germany which has inflexibly insisted on the continued harsh imposition of inhuman austerity measures in Greece and the other countries of the European South, measures which have been found repeatedly to violate the basic human rights of the citizens of Greece and other countries. All the while, Germany has benefited handsomely from an economic point of view, both from the returns it is receiving on the loans it has imposed on Greece and from the brain drain of the European South, with many educated young people from Southern Europe finding their way to Germany. The same Germany whose finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble, who apparently is also the finance minister of Greece and Portugal and Italy and Spain, has said, "Elections change nothing, there are rules." This is the same Germany that has remained completely inflexible on the issue of Greece's debt, and this is the same Germany who we are told is, quote, the leader of the free world. So Germany has been whitewashed and thrust into the role of world leader of peace, justice, freedom, and democracy by the same global media empire which openly and unabashedly supported Hillary Clinton in the US presidential elections and insisted ad nauseum that she would easily defeat Donald Trump. The United States, of course, can no longer fulfill the role of so-called leader of the free world in the eyes of the media because the fascist Russian agent Trump is president instead of the honorable Secretary Clinton, who once cackled on TV, "We came, we saw, he died." Oh, but I forgot, when it's your guy or gal fighting wars and killing sovereign leaders overseas, it's okay. That must explain why the quote-unquote anti-war movement went extinct right around the time that Barack Hope and Change Obama became president. That must also explain why George W. Bush, whose administration invaded Afghanistan and Iraq on false pretenses, has, just like Merkel, been whitewashed, as evidenced by his recent appearance on Ellen. After all, he purportedly hates Trump, therefore, he must not be that bad of a guy. Similarly, when Obama deported record numbers of illegal immigrants from the United States, when he bailed out banks responsible for the economic collapse of 2007-2008 and refused to prosecute even one of them, but instead prosecuted whistleblowers, when he waged 7 wars and dropped over 20,000 bombs from drones and failed to shutter the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay, he too was whitewashed. Indeed, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and he gets to dine with celebrity social justice warriors such as Bono, while receiving star treatment wherever he goes. When he referred to the, quote, 57 states of the United States, just like when Representative Maxine Waters referred to Putin's invasion of, quote, Korea, the media gave them a free pass. No Bowling Green treatment for them. For those with their eyes open all of these years, it is easy to realize that not only were the US and international media subservient and compliant during the 8 years of the Obama administration, but they also never hit the Bush administration nearly as hard as they hit Trump. At best, Bush's Bushisms served as late-night TV comedy fodder, downplaying their seriousness. I clearly remember the same media in lockstep with the Bush administration and the Afghanistan and Iraq war marches, while voices who dared to oppose these invasions were canned in short order, even by the purportedly liberal MSNBC. Remember Phil Donahue? Me either. At that time, not only was there a supposed anti-war movement, but there were also many activists decrying the media's hawkish slant and the concentration of media outlets in the hands of a few huge corporations. Just like the, quote, anti-war movement, these voices of dissent against the corporate media have shut up now. With the media attacking Trump 24/7, fear-mongering non-stop over the Russian menace and the tyrant Vladimir Putin, who we are told rivals only Trump in his resemblance to Hitler, and with anyone who dares to support Brexit or the elimination of so-called free trade agreements such as TPP and TTIP, which would place multinational corporations above domestic law, denounced as a fascist and racist and xenophobe, the very same ex-activists have become the biggest shills and cheerleaders for the very same corporate media which they once loudly decried. Take Brexit as a case in point. Those who chose to take back the sovereignty of their country and who speak out against the unelected supranational German-dominated behemoth in Brussels have been branded as racists and nationalists and xenophobes. These are the scarlet letters of today's progressive and globalist age. No one cares that many of these voters are not racist, but are very much concerned about the fact that they do not have jobs, or are unable to support themselves and their families with their current dead-end employment, that the economy and infrastructure of their country is crumbling, and that there is additional downward pressure being placed on their wages and on a social state through the imposition of cheap, flexible labor from countries who have been torn apart as a result of Western-imposed war and conflict, such as in Syria. Countries that are, in other words, war-torn and impoverished with the support of the very same people who are now clamoring for, quote, open borders, and who are, without a hint of irony, branding their opponents as racists and xenophobes. Because that's what it's all about. Foster crisis, force people to flee, and use their desperation to pit them against the poorer classes in your society, to drive wages down and profits up. That's what the whole idea behind open borders and refugees welcome and creating the conditions which lead to refugees and a brain drain is all about, in case you haven't realized it. There are protests, of course. Protests in favor of uprooting refugees and providing them special privileges and decimating the working class and the middle class some more. Protests in favor of the austerity-driven Eurozone and European Union. Protests which sprung up like magic the moment Donald Trump became president, when for the past 8 years there was hardly any protest against austerity in Europe, or war and drone strikes in the Middle East, or the record numbers of deportations under Obama's watch. We're supposed to believe the tens of thousands of protesters in all corners of the United States, for instance, were able to obtain pink hats in short order and were able to coordinate and to send a message to Trump before he even entered the Oval Office. Here, it is important to remember that there are three components to every protest: what is being advocated for as an alternative, and who is organizing the protest, and what their ulterior motives may be. It's no coincidence, therefore, that anti-war protests during the 8 years of Obama's reign barely registered a blip on the radar and were thoroughly ignored by the mass media when they occurred. But protests during the 2 months of Trump's presidency have enjoyed abundant and positive media coverage. To share an example from Greece, rallies that were organized in the lead-up to the country's July 2015 referendum on accepting an EU-proposed austerity package, and which were in favor of a no vote, drew hundreds of thousands of people, despite having only a few days' notice of the referendum. Following the referendum, however, when the no vote, which prevailed, was thoroughly betrayed by the Syriza-led coalition government, participation at protests against this betrayal numbered a few hundred people tops. The reasons should be obvious to anybody with their eyes open. And to add to this, the oh-so-leftist Syriza government gets a pass. Its betrayal excused away as a result of being blackmailed by the EU. In the same breath, however, Syriza's globalist apologists then tell us that Greece must remain in the EU at all costs, and what a great, noble thing the EU's open borders and free movement of peoples is, and how Greece will collapse and die if it leaves the euro. Political schizophrenia at its finest. If you're protesting something because you wish to return to the previous status quo, where you turned a blind eye to everything you now claim to be protesting, then you are disingenuous and hypocritical at best. One should also never forget to also ask, where's the money and logistical support and the perfectly crafted slogans and hashtags and the massive amounts of pink hats coming from? Answer that, and you also answer what is actually being advocated and who is organizing these protests. Personally, I'll never forget the disappearance of the so-called anti-war movement after Obama was elected, the support of Democrats and many alleged progressives for the bombing and destruction of Serbia, and the dismantling of the Balkans under the watch of Bill Clinton, their blind support of the grossly undemocratic EU, and the despicable branding of anyone opposed to it as a racist and xenophobe, and their silence when Hope and Change was bailing out major banks, while ordinary people of all colors were losing their homes and 20,000 bombs were being dropped across 7 wars that were being waged. All of this while the media and while most activist groups remained silent. Now suddenly Trump is the problem? Anyone who truly is concerned about human rights, instead of blindly parroting the open borders and refugees welcome agenda, should ask themselves why there are refugees in the first place, and who started and who is perpetuating the conflict that is forcing them to flee. And anyone who is truly concerned about democracy should ask themselves if majorities of people in several countries suddenly became fascists overnight, or if there are other legitimate reasons why they do not support so-called free trade, or open borders, or supranational institutional behemoths such as the EU. To be clear, this isn't an endorsement of Donald Trump, but it also is not an endorsement of the McCarthyite witch hunt, the media hysteria and scaremongering against Russia, or their pro-Hillary and pro-Obama and pro-EU propaganda. Moreover, it is not an endorsement of the incumbent establishment. What more evidence is needed to see that there's no such thing as Democrats and Republicans, for instance? There's an incumbent neoliberal establishment defended by the corporate mass media and its prostitutes, by the military-industrial complex, and by elite billionaires, and there are those who stand in its way or who are perceived as standing in its way. Which side are you on? This is the Allegos Radio, where today's broadcast is just about ready to come to a close. On our upcoming broadcasts, we will have the opportunity to speak with Greek economist Spiros Lavdiotis, a former analyst for the Central Bank of Canada, who will speak to us about the development of the modern doctrine of austerity, about the issue of Greece's debt, and about the steps that could be followed in order to achieve an orderly departure from the Eurozone, among other pertinent issues. And as always, be sure to visit us online at thealogosmedia.org for our latest articles, commentaries, podcasts, our program archives, and to listen to our online radio station, The Allegos Radio 24/7. For The Allegos Radio, this is Michael Navradakis. Thank you for joining us today.